Let's go ahead and have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It's 1:32 on the afternoon of Friday, February 25th, year 2011. We've got three bills in front of us today: SB 17, synthetic cannabinoids; SB 11, hate crimes; SB 39, U.S. Presidential Compact. We'll start with SB 17, and we'll go ahead and have the prime sponsors, ABLE staff, come forward. Good afternoon. And before we do, before we hear from you, though, we do have a committee substitute /D before the committee. If there could be a motion to put that in front of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that the committee adopt /D as the version before us on Senate Bill number 17.
Is there objection? Hearing none, /D is before us. And now we will turn to Christine Marsigan from Senator Meyer's office. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator French and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Christine Marsigan, and I am staff to Senator Kevin Meyer, who represents Senate District O. Senator Meyer had other business to attend to this afternoon and regrets not being able to be here today. As was heard previously, Senate Bill 17 would classify synthetic cannabinoids as a controlled substance. The CS you have before you would move the substances that is commonly found in K2 and spice, including its salts and isomers, from Schedule 2A, which is in Alaska Statutes 1171-150, to 3A, which is in 11.71-260. I'd like to note for the record that there were several letters of support, including the Alaska Peace Officers Association, Women Police of Alaska, Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police, Municipality of Anchorage, Alaska Mental Health Board and Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, and the Fairbanks Police. If you have any additional questions, I'm more than happy to attempt to answer them. I believe we also have someone from the municipality online, Ms. Jennifer Messick. I also think we might even have a few folks from Department of Public Safety if you have any other questions.
We will take a look at that list. Yep, we have, for questions, we have Lieutenant Dial. For questions, we have Orrin Dimm. For questions, we have Jeff Mittman. And we have also for questions Beth Trimmer, the acting deputy director at OPA. Maybe Ms. Marsigan, you can just put on the record your understanding of the change from a 2A to a 3A schedule has what general effect on the severity of the penalties associated with the possession of cannabinoids.
Senator French, as was discussed previously, but the difference between Schedule 2A and Schedule 3A is that a first offense, which includes possession, under Schedule 2A, the previous bill, it would be a Class C felony, although, you know, there would probably be some room there for presumptive sentence in terms of suspending sentences. And for Schedule 3A, which is what the current CS addresses, it would be a Class A misdemeanor, and that is maximum 1 year imprisonment and a $10,000 fine.
Any questions for the bill's sponsor? I don't see any. We do, or we were expecting a testimony from someone from the municipality of Anchorage. I don't see that person signed up on this list, but if you're listening and you can hear me from the municipality of Anchorage, go ahead and put yourself on the record. Nobody there.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill. Oh, and let's welcome Senator Coghill to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you for the welcome. Sorry about being late. One of the questions that I might have was on both bills, but now that I think we're under the T of the new bill.
We're on SB 17, yep. And you should have /D Delta.
Delta, okay. All right. Which I don't have in front of me. Sorry.
Then you do now.
Okay. The effective date was the question I had on the effect to people who have already stocked up things. How would the implementation go from passage of this bill to taking things off the shelf?
Lacking an immediate effective date, my understanding would be that if the governor were to sign this into law, it would become effective 90 days later.
90 days.
Maybe, actually, Ms. Carpinetti, maybe you can come forward and answer the question with some authority rather than some something less than that.
Mr. Chairman, my main concern was that that 90 days for an industry that had anticipated a market. Obviously, we think that the market is bad, but I would like to make sure that there was enough notice for them to change their behavior.
Ms. Carpinetti, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the criminal division of the Department of Law. The CS right now has an immediate effective date.
I see.
Which
so it would be the day the governor signs the bill?
I think the day after.
The day after.
So I think that's a concern, Mr. Chairman, that just not that I want the industry to have them on their shelves, but I think what happens is they become liable the moment it's signed without any preparation. That I don't know that that's – I don't know if that's good public policy.
You know, I had hoped to hear from someone from the municipality. I think the – oh, okay. Okay, good. Let's do that. Thank you, Ms. Carpinetti. We have a witness from the municipality of Anchorage. If you go ahead and put yourself on the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jennifer Messick. I'm a traffic safety resource prosecutor with the municipality of Anchorage.
Ms. Messick, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, through the committee, again, my name is Jennifer. I'm a traffic safety resource prosecutor. I work for the municipality. I've been there for about 5.5 years. I'd like to offer testimony relating to the SPICE and K2 bill. Two main areas. The first, some considerations for scheduling, and then a second area, some kind of specialized considerations. In that first area, there's 5 points, and I'd first like to, as a guideline, kind of draw your attention to 1171.120, and that lays out some factors that are recommended to take into consideration when determining where a drug should be scheduled. So maybe there's discussion of whether it should be in Schedule 2 or Schedule 3 or some other place. Those factors lay out a very good guideline for determining where it would be appropriate to be scheduled. It's the municipality's position, or we support scheduling it in 2A for 5 main reasons, and they really kind of tailor or dovetail with those factors. The first reason is because other cyclic drugs or cyclic drugs are in Schedule 2A, and SPICE is also a cyclic drug. The effects of SPICE are very similar to PCP and LSD. They are much more like those drugs than they are like marijuana. LSD, PCP, and SPICE are all, I said the word cyclic, that basically means that they affect users differently and very unpredictably. One person may hallucinate or become violent or dissociate from pain. That's where we often hear the superhuman strength. Another user may become relaxed or simply lose consciousness. There's no way to actually predict how a user is going to be affected, and even the same user can experience very different symptoms the next time around. And what we've seen both through EMS and law enforcement and schools all across the country and in Alaska is that the effects produced from SPICE and K2 actually seem to be kind of a combination of the effects that you would see with LSD, PCP, and methamphetamine. I can give you some examples on a more local level. In December 14th of 2010, Anchorage Police got a phone call from two females. Their roommates, they also had a male roommate. They said, hey, our male roommate isn't breathing. Can you come over? APD got there. The young man's heart was stopped. The medics got it restarted. They transported him to the hospital. He was not breathing on his own. He was on life support. And about 4 days later, his parents made the very difficult decision to remove him from life support. His two female roommates said that they had not been doing any other drugs, and they, except for smoking SPICE, they had all smoked it together. They had all smoked the same package. And so it had very different effect on that young man than it did on the two females. What happened to that young man was very consistent with what also happened to a 16-year-old in Montana whose parents didn't understand what this drug was. They, in fact, gave him the money to go buy it. He took about 3 hits, and very, very similarly, his heart stopped. Medics got it restarted. During transport, it stopped again, and they were not able to revive him. Again, no other drugs on board. And when we talk about the cyclic effects or cyclic effects, APD also had gotten a call from a worker at a gas station, said, "Hey, there's this guy on the street or on the sidewalk. He's yelling at his cell phone. Can you come check it out?" Two APD officers responded, walked up to the young man. "Hey, is everything okay? What's going on? Are you all right?" Without any further provocation, the young man reached out and grabbed Officer Lamb's gun and was yanking on it, trying to get it out of the holster. It eventually took six police officers. They ended up having to break a wooden nightstick over his head. And then he reengaged, was trying to go after their gun again, and they had to tase him not once but twice. Again, after each time, he was going for their weapons again, and eventually they just had to render him unconscious in order to gain control of him. And there are several other examples of that kind of superhuman strength, again, that police officers normally see associated with PCP. Very different from that are the effects that marijuana and hash that you see with those drugs. Those drugs affect people similarly and in a very predictable way. Generally, people are tired, lazy, hungry, maybe euphoric, or relaxed, but they certainly don't produce, marijuana and hash do not produce the effects that you see with these drugs. And then also how Alaska compares, this is kind of the second point, how Alaska compares with the rest of the United States. The incidents that we are seeing from APD, from the fire department in Anchorage, from school officials and stuff in Anchorage, and to a certain extent all over the state, is very consistent with other reports around the country. If you consult U.S. Poison Control, they will tell you that symptoms that they are aware of are much more like meth or methamphetamine and PCP than they are like marijuana.
Ms. Messig, if you can hear me, maybe you've touched a mute button, but we can't hear you any longer. Just dropped off. That's unfortunate. I had questions for her.
Me too.
Why don't we just take a short at ease. We're back on the record, and we may have regained the witness we'd lost. Ms. Messick, can you hear me? Jennifer Messick?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, we lost you somehow here.
No problem. Should are you ready for testimony on the Spice and K2 bill?
We are.
Okay. Shall I start from the beginning, sir?
No. You were near the end. Or at least it felt like you've been testifying for some time. I think we may have maybe we can just start with committee questions, and that'll help you direct your testimony to areas of concern and curiosity. Senator Pascman.
Sure. I was wondering whether the department that you work in has any peer-reviewed studies that addresses this subject.
Mr. Chairman, and through the committee, I work for the municipality, and no, we do not have any studies, and there are no studies, scientific studies, on human beings, and that's with good reason. The researcher who developed this, John W. Hoffman, there was kind of a competition in the mid-90s among pharmaceutical companies to develop a synthetic cannabinoid that had all of the medicinally desirable things about marijuana and none of the bad things. In the process, they made some mistakes. They didn't get it right the first time. And the compounds that are very commonly found in Spice and K2 are the mistakes. They got as far as testing them on rats and pigeons. They never, ever got to testing it on humans. When they saw the effects on rats and pigeons, they took, basically, for lack of a better word, those recipes, and they put them in the trash can and said, this is not suitable for human testing. And that's where they've remained, is in that trash can. However, scientists publish their results even when they fall short of their goal. And, again, for lack of a better term, you then have basement scientists who will basically look in the trash can, get those recipes, and pull them out because it's something that can get them high. These compounds were never intended for human consumption, and there is absolutely no legitimate use, medical or otherwise, for them. Even though it's marketed as incense, it is not intended to make anything smell good. The only purpose is to get you high, and it's very dangerous precisely because it has not been studied, and nor will it be studied because it's just way too dangerous.
Follow-up?
Yeah, do you have any report on that history for the last 20 years? In other words, you're saying something that I assume, if you've been in the department for 5.5 years, it's not something you track for 20 years, but where does that knowledge come from? What's your source information?
And, Mr. Chairman, through the committee, there are a number of articles that have been published about these compounds and about where they came from and how they were manufactured. John W. Hoffman, again, the researcher who came up with most of these compounds, has been quoted in a number of those articles, saying such things as, you know, if you use these drugs, you're playing Russian roulette. They were never intended for human beings. He's also said, you know, if you use these, you're just stupid, and has expressed his disgust in how they're being used, that they were never intended to be used by that. To clarify for the record, the municipality only became aware of these drugs or of these compounds in April of 2010. We had been seeing a number of DUI cases where impairment was very severe, but there was no alcohol on board and the blood was coming back with nothing detected, that we were starting to see a pattern with those cases where it was very obvious people were impaired. In April last year, kind of the light bulb came on and we realized that the majority of those cases involve spice. And so then we started doing some research on what that compound was or what those compounds were, and since then have amassed an extensive depth of knowledge on it. I personally have traveled outside to a number of other states and conducted training for law enforcement, for the military, and counter-drug intelligence officials on this drug and what it is and how it affects people. So to answer your question, no, you're correct. We have not been tracking it for 20 years. Really, we've been, I guess you could say that we've been seeing it at least in an identifiable way since April. Before that, for about 18 months, I would say we had a number of cases that involved it. So does that answer your question, sir?
Not really. You know, what I'm trying to focus on, you use the term or the name Dr. Hoffman as one that I assume he's a chemist or, medical biologist of some sort. But is there something from him saying that this is what he was intending upon doing? You know, what's the source documents on where these cannabinoids originally came from and that they're not intended for human consumption?
It would not be difficult at all. I can certainly provide that information to the committee. I mean, I've got it. I just don't have it at my fingertips at the moment.
Well, actually, I have a question. The Senator Wilikowski has a question. The municipality took action on this substance earlier this year. We heard testimony, I think, last week that the municipality assembly of Anchorage decided to make possession of K2, in essence, a traffic ticket. Is K2 still available in Anchorage commercially?
Again, Mr. Chairman, through the committee, yes, spice and K2 compounds that are normally found in it are available commercially. It's still available. You can get it at the black market. You can get it at any number of tobacco shops or head shops. You used to be able to get it at a number of convenience stores. They market it right next to the 5-Hour Energy drinks where it's convenient and attractive for our young kids. So, yes, it is still available. part of, if I can take just a moment and explain part of the reason why the municipality was so very quick to enact that legislation, and we did so because we can only make it a misdemeanor. You're correct. We also made it a traffic citation. The officer can use their discretion whether they, I say traffic citation, it's actually a civil cite, whether they want to cite civilly or whether they want to go the misdemeanor route. But the reason we did so is we can't make that a felony. We don't have the authority to do that. But part of the reason that we took such quick measures is because of we've had a number of high school students that have been hospitalized overnight. They've lost consciousness, had blood pressure that was out of control, where the doctors couldn't get it under control. Hallucinations, seeing black bunny rabbits, seeing ghosts, seeing dead people, delusions. Anchorage Fire Department actually has a number of calls that they have responded to without APD. Unconscious, fainting, an overdose, assault, breathing problems, again, unconscious, impending doom, hallucinations, shortness of breath, altered level of consciousness, combative. And one of the things that makes this drug so dangerous, and I'll try and be brief here, but I think this is an important point, is the people who came out with this and started marketing it, not the researchers, but the people who started marketing it, were really kind of geniuses, because they could just as easily have put this stuff on a sugar cube or dropped it on a piece of paper. But then that would look like acid, and nobody wants to be seen as being an acid user. And the number one most commonly abused drug in the United States, next to alcohol, is marijuana. And so if they just put it on some green plant material that's dried, it doesn't really matter what it is that they put it on, then it looks like marijuana. And because it was created in the process of trying to come up with something that had medicinal value, then they can say, oh, it's a synthetic marijuana. When you combine their three factors, it makes it very attractive to kids. When you combine, number one, the fact that in our country we rely very heavily on our government to protect us from things that are harmful. And one of the ways they do that is they criminalize it. And when we haven't done that yet, that sends a very clear message that we don't think it's any big deal. And then you take the idea that it's synthetic, and we all kind of, you know, we're used to our synthetic fabrics, and, you know, we don't like the itchy wool anymore. Synthetic is so much better. You combine those two things with this idea that it's all natural and it's this herbal blend, and it seems like it's kind of harmless, or, you know, maybe it's kind of homeopathic and not quite as good. And you combine those three things, and I think it targets a segment of the population that may not normally experiment with drugs, and especially a lot of kids that may not normally experiment with drugs. And so I think the city took those factors into consideration, and then the number of incidents that were occurring in our schools with our kids, situations our police officers that were in that really implicated their safety and the public safety, and our medics and fire department officials, and they said, we're going to try and react now, and we're going to react the best way that we can. But I think if we had the authority to make it a felony, we would have.
Okay, I guess I'm still confused by your answer. I don't understand, and I need some clarity on this. Is possession of K2 in the municipality of Anchorage a misdemeanor that can send you to jail for 6 months, or is it a traffic ticket that I show up in court and pay a fine on?
It can be either. There's actually 835-100 in our code lays out four subsections, and subsections A and B are more for people who are distributing it, stores that are selling it, that sort of thing, and those are mandatory misdemeanor violations. Subsection C and D are more for your low-level possession. Maybe you've got a kid that's just got a little bit of it on them, or somebody's just got a little bit. The officer could cite it as a misdemeanor, or they could instead choose to just use the civil fine. Part of the reason that I believe that the city did that was because we also don't have the authority to prosecute juveniles for misdemeanor offenses that are not traffic.
Okay, so okay, fair enough. I understand, but I guess I just have now. I have a follow-up question. If it's a misdemeanor punishable by up to 6 months in jail for a person or entity to sell K2, which is I see 835-100A in your municipal code, I guess I'm having a hard time buying that head shops are still putting this out on the counter when an APD officer could walk in at any time of the day or night and arrest that clerk and charge that person with a crime and potentially expose that clerk to 6 months in jail for selling K2.
You bring up an excellent point, and let me explain why that's happening. And it is happening. The shops are still selling it. And this was kind of under my second point of special considerations is that the people who make this stuff and are manufacturing it and distributing it, they anticipate that we're going to criminalize it. And on the shelf, ready to go, they have analog compounds. Those compounds affect us in the same way, but structurally they may be just slightly different. So that technically, it's not JWH-018 or JWH-200 or HU-210. But it is analogous in its effect. And so they can spray those chemicals or those compounds on it, and then they can market it and say, look, it doesn't contain any of the compounds that have been banned. Now,
okay, Ms. Messick, I have a question. Have you tested that with chemistry, or is this your supposition? And I don't mean to say it disparagingly, but I mean, have APD people arrested a clerk selling K2 and then tested that substance, or are you just telling me sort of how you expect it to play out in the future?
No, sir. They have not, because we can't test it right now. There isn't a test available for law enforcement to be able to take some of this plant material and have it tested. That's not available to us yet. But we know that they are using analog compounds, because if you go on the internet, which is a great place to buy it, they'll tell you this is what we're doing.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski has questions.
Yes. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Messick, is Anchorage seeing problems with other drugs like meth or heroin or crack or cocaine? Are you seeing?
Are we seeing problems with it?
Yeah.
Heroin is very very popular in Anchorage. Methamphetamine is certainly around. I don't think I could say that we don't have problems with it. Is there a particular type of problem that you're inquiring about?
All of those drugs are currently illegal, and I guess in the case of cocaine and crack and heroin are probably felonies, and you're still seeing problems with them, and I'm just wondering why you think if we outlaw synthetic cannabinoids, we will somehow see this problem go away.
And that's a very good point. Legislation is merely a framework for further work that is going to need to be done. Without it, we're going to be helpless. There's nothing that we can do. So, number one, it's going to provide us a framework for future action. But I think most importantly, what it does is it sends a very clear message to people in our state, this stuff is dangerous. And when we put it in the same category as things like PCP and LSD and methamphetamine, because it has very similar effects up to it, manufacturing processes are very uncontrolled in all of those drugs. The effects are very unpredictable in all of those drugs. They're all synthetic. None of them are organic. when we put them in the same category, it's like telling people the Spice K2, the compounds that are on it, it's bad. And that's one of the ways that our government protects its people, is we identify things that are very, very harmful, and we say, you shouldn't use these things, you shouldn't have access to them. I don't think I can go so far as to say that Anchorage doesn't have LSD and PCP and methamphetamine, but, any of the drugs that have been criminalized, you're going to see. I mean, you're never going to be able to stop all of it. But again, I think that when we criminalize it, we send a message, and there will be a certain segment of society that doesn't use it because they get that message loud and clear, this is dangerous, and it's going to have similar effects to these other dangerous drugs.
And follow-up question, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, well, just a comment, but I mean, if as a government we started criminalizing everything that was dangerous for people, we would probably have half our population in jail. On another point, I mean, how many people are in jail right now for drug-related offenses in Anchorage? Do you know?
I have no idea. No idea.
And when, if I could, Mr. Chair, when you talked about a number of instances, and you mentioned a pattern, how many people have you found to have been using synthetic cannabinoids?
I would have to say at least several hundred, if not thousands. And the reason I say that is that I can say several hundred, but again, we've only been able to identify this just since April of 2010. So in less than a year, several thousand incidents, and that's for several hundred, I'm sorry. But consider this. Those numbers are only from APD, the fire department, and school officials. So the only time those folks get notified is when something bad happens. So that's the number of bad things that have happened to people, like when they go unconscious, when they have seizures, when they have high blood pressure, when they hallucinate, when they are delusional and paranoid and aggressive and combative. There are certainly a number of other times that these compounds don't cause those effects in users. I mean, just like PCP, somebody can have a PCP trip or an acid trip and not have it be really, really bad and not have it be unpleasant. Same thing with this drug. There are sometimes people are going to use it and they're not going to have a bad trip. So when I say that we're aware of several hundred incidents in less than a year, that's just the number of bad incidents. I mean, we would have to assume that the number of actual incidents or actual use of it is much higher than that. We do know just from national statistics that the main age group or most common age group is 14 to 27 years of age. That's a pretty young segment of our population. And I have to agree with what the other senator said with it. You know, if we started criminalizing everything that was dangerous, half the people would be in jail. Completely agree. But this drug isn't like other things that are dangerous. This drug is like PCP and LSD and methamphetamine. Those drugs are dangerous, and they're scheduled in Schedule 2 because they're dangerous, and also because of the other factors or considerations laid out in 1171-120.
Ms. Messick, Senator Wilkowski has a question, and then Senator Pasquin.
Mr. Chair, I know we have other business on today, and so, but I do have some other questions.
Please.
And Ms. Messick, your testimony has been very valuable. I really appreciate it. One question that I have is, Where does this lead? I mean, my understanding is it's very hard, if impossible, to test for someone who's using synthetic marijuana. So I'm just wondering, the police pull someone over, they suspect that they have used synthetic marijuana, they find no evidence in the car. Can they now gain a search warrant to go and search their house for this substance? Is that where we're headed with this?
Under that fact pattern, I would say that the officers wouldn't even attempt to get a search warrant for their house. That wouldn't be appropriate. If the officer, through field sobriety tests and other observations, believes that the person is impaired to a degree that they're unable to safely drive a vehicle, then they could perhaps get a search warrant for their blood. And we are able, and they do that already in any type of DUI case where impairment is obvious and it's inconsistent with a breath result. And maybe you blow triple zeros, but you can't stand up, you can't talk, you're vomiting all over yourself, and your blood pressure's through the roof, and I mean any number of other symptoms that indicate impairment, they're already get search warrants. So if we get the blood, we do have the ability to test for it in the blood. I say we. There is one lab currently in the United States that can detect it in the blood. That test is about $200, but we do have the ability to utilize that lab. It's kind of a difficult process, but there are a number of other labs across the United States. I think at last count there were five that are able to detect it in the urine. Now there's a certain window of collection, or a certain window of time in which you have to collect the blood or urine within, 8 hours for blood and 3 days for urine, but this drug and the prevalence of it is so widespread across the United States. It's not like meth where you first saw it in Hawaii and then it gradually goes to the West Coast and 5 or 6 years later you see it on the East Coast. It is everywhere all at once, and it is a problem in all 50 states. If we had time, I could certainly provide you with statistics and specific case information from every state that has had problems with this. So it would make sense if we started seeing other labs developing tests for it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it's helpful. Thank you.
Senator Pascan.
Thank you. Your comments are helpful. Wouldn't it be an important starting point if we wanted to convey the message to the age group 14 to 27 that it's illegal and not to be used if we were to ban and make criminal the manufacture, sale, or distribution? In other words, go to the top of the pyramid as compared to the bottom?
To answer your question directly, yes, absolutely. And I think that the most effective approach is a shotgun approach rather than just a slug approach. Kids can get this stuff off the internet. It's very, very easy to get off the internet. So even if we just banned the manufacturer and sale of it in Alaska, they're still going to have ready access to it over the internet. If we can make possession of it illegal as well, I think that shoots a broader net, so to speak, and would be more effective.
Let me just say, I mean, Ms. Messick, this is Senator French, and just for the purposes of discussion, I think it's I'm not sure how many kids have credit cards. It's hard to buy stuff over the internet without a credit card. But I'm not disputing the basic idea. But I guess the concern I'm having now with this bill is becoming interested in the next generation. That is, how can we best craft a piece of legislation that keeps us from having to craft legislation every year in response to the newest version? And so at this point, I'm getting interested in hearing some testimony from a chemist, or I guess from a chemist slash a lawyer, who can tell me how broad I can make the language, capture as many of these items as possible, still give fair warning to the individuals who may be crafting them or distributing them, and at the same time work on, you know, the issues that Senator Wilkowski brings up and Senator Pascan, which is, you know, if you shut down the manufacturer, then the possession issue goes away. And it always somewhat irritates me, as I'm sure it irritates others, to see the big fish moving on and, you know, the dumb kid from Anchorage who gets a little pocketful of this stuff in his pocket go to jail or have his future ruined over it. So, Senator Pascan, you still had a question.
Just as a follow-up, you indicated future action. Were you indicating future legislative action? And if so, what is it that you were indicating?
If I can respond briefly to Mr. Chairman's comment. If we were to merely make possession illegal, one of the things we understand about these compounds is that the compounds in their pure form, it's like a white powder, and then they dissolve it in acetone and they spray it onto the plant material. So if possession were not illegal, then they could possess, and they actually can make it. I mean, a researcher said if you have a background in science and chemistry and some household chemicals, you can make this stuff, which sounds a lot like meth. But again, I mean, that covers your point of manufacturing it. But then if they possess it and that's not illegal, why are they possessing it? They're possessing it because they're going to put it on the plant material. There's no other reason why they'd have it. Perhaps if there was a distinction made between how much you possess or what form it's in, but then again, that's suggesting to society that it's okay to possess it in one form but not the other because it's less harmful. And I'm not sure that we want to send that message. But Mr. Chairman, you also hit the nail on the head when you said, hey, how can we draft a law so that we don't have to keep going back and playing catch-up? And you hit the nail on the head with that, because there are two problems with any type of legislation targeting these compounds. And one is that they do have analog compounds ready to go. How broad can we make that language without running into constitutional objections that is overbroad? I don't have the answer to that. Just simply bringing that up as a valid point. States that have criminalized this have already run into that problem. And then also the remaining failed recipes in the trash can. These basement scientists, they can just keep reaching in and pulling out those other recipes that were never intended for humans, and they can make it and get high. So very, very good point, and it's a valid point that we have to be very careful in how the wording is drafted, and how close can we get, how broad can we throw that net without drawing objections, and valid objections.
Senator Willikowski has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, in other words, yeah, so I don't know.
Senator Paskin, go ahead.
I don't, you know, my question to you was, as you use the term future action, and my question to you was, is did you mean legislative action, and if so, what legislative action do you see occurring in the future?
And I'm sorry, the context that I used future action, I'm not clear on the question, sir.
Okay, you would just use the term future action, that this was in the context of this legislation was a part of something. And so my question was, is there a future legislative action that you were contemplating? And I just was, anyway, if it's not intended that way, then I withdraw the question.
Senator Willikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that there are potentially hundreds of ways that these cannabinoids can be tweaked, and that if we pass this bill, the next day they'll be hard at work creating new chemical compounds. So I agree with you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if there isn't a more comprehensive look way that we can look at that. And I guess I would also agree, just a comment, but I think if we were to look in our jails, we'll probably find a huge number of people who are sitting in jail for possession of minor amounts of drugs. And I don't know, we sometimes create lifetime criminals out of those people, and it costs the state and the country hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. And I just wonder if our efforts wouldn't be better directed towards banning the substance at the manufacturer level, or really having more aggressive penalties at the manufacturer level. You know, when people try to produce dangerous foods or put dangerous products into our food system, we try to stop the manufacturer of those foods. And I think that might be just that, from a policy perspective, a little better way to go than throwing 17-year-old kids in jail for, possessing this substance.
I did see a member of our legislative legal department wave his hand at me, and I'm not sure if he was volunteering to testify or not. Mr. Luckupt. Why don't you come forward, we'll pose the question, and then I think what we're going to wind up doing is hold this bill over. I think, you know, we're zeroing in on a problem, and I think I just need to work on the problem and fix the problem once, or at least as infrequently as possible. Welcome to the committee.
For the record, my name is Jerry Luckup, Assistant Reviser of Statutes for the Alaska Legislature. Hi.
And you heard the question. I mean, and I just don't know if we've confronted this in the past with other substances, but how broadly can you cast a definition to still put people on notice that what they're doing is illegal and sort of encompass future mutations without running afoul of the Constitution?
Mr. Chairman, I've attempted to draft the bill as broadly as I think it's possible right now. I've listed 11 different substances, 10 or 11, and those are all the ones that any other state has made illegal. I've also used language about isomers, optical isomers, positional isomers, geometric isomers, which cover the normal ways that someone makes an analog. They'll go ahead and, for example, with a salt, you're basically removing a hydrogen atom from it. And I'm not a chemist. I took chemistry in high school and college, but I had to
I think you're safe in front of this panel.
I had to do these prosecutions a long time ago, and in a former life I had. And so a salt is you remove basically a hydrogen atom, and you throw in something else, an alkyl atom or something like that. And that's fairly common. The isomers are when you place a particular atom, let's say we've got the little balls and the little sticks, the Tinker Toys and everything, you're making this, you go ahead and move it over here. Theoretically, it's a different substance, but it is an isomer of the other substance. Geometric means that it looks similar. There's this that the molecules are placed in different spots, and that's the same drug. I've been able to, you know, I have that included. If it's a mirror isomer, it's like your hands. If you try to put a left glove on your right hand, it doesn't go on right, you know. But they're mirrors. You put them up against each other, they look exactly the same, just like with a mirror. That ends up being the way I drafted it, are the same drug. The problem comes if you just try to say things that are similar, or that anything, you try to say anything that's an analog or homolog of something, then we aren't given notice to those people that we're trying to throw in jail for a felony. And states have been very unsuccessful in doing that. The feds did pass a thing called the Federal Analog Act some 30 years ago. To date, there have been prosecutions that number probably in the tens under this thing. It purports to say that anything that's a Schedule 1 or 2 drug under federal law, anything that does has similar effects, and if you market it as being the same as one of those drugs, then it's automatically illegal. A federal district court in Colorado found it unconstitutional. They've never prosecuted it again. That was when I was a prosecutor in Wyoming, and so I was aware of this case down there. There's been one circuit court that found it constitutional. Various other courts have been up in the air, and it's basically not used except in very rare situations, and it usually is to negotiate with someone on another matter.
Let me ask another.
We've gone where we can, I think.
Let me ask you a question. Has the federal government taken action on these substances?
The federal government is in the process of listing five of these substances. One of them that we have listed is already listed. HU210 is already listed as a Schedule 2, I believe, under federal law. The others, there's five others that are going to be listed. They listed them in November, December. There was a lawsuit saying that they hadn't followed the correct procedure in listing it, hadn't done the requisite studies to find that it's dangerous or not. And the feds have started that process over again.
Let me turn to any more questions for Mr. Luckett. Let me turn to Orrin Dim. Orrin Dim's on the line. He's with our Public Safety Crime Lab. Mr. Dim, are you there?
Mr. Chairman, I am present.
Thank you. And you've been following the discussion. My question for you is whether if we pass this bill, make possession and distribution a felony, make distribution a felony, possession a misdemeanor, and APD or the troopers go out and bust a head shop that have a rack of K2 for sale for display, can you test it to tell them whether or not that substance is against the law? Can you do that there in our crime lab?
For the record, my name is Orrin Dim. I'm the forensic laboratory manager. Mr. Chairman, the answer is in terms of the solid material, whether it be a plant or something of that matter for possession, we would need to purchase standards to compare to, but we do have the instrumentation and the expertise, and we would rapidly be able to develop methods and provide that service, yes.
But so it sounds like as it stands right now, the answer is no, but you would be able to gear up and do so in the near future.
Mr. Chairman, correct.
And I take it that APD hasn't brought you any cases based on their ordinance.
Mr. Chairman, APD did contact us, and we explained to them that we were not capable at this time of doing it, that if it became a state law, that we would then be prepared to do that.
Thank you. Further questions from Mr. Dimm. Senator Pascan.
What's the estimated expense for the equipment that you would need? Or is there going to be additional staff needed?
Through the chair, Senator Pascan, the standards for these materials to compare to are very expensive. Our last quote when we looked was about $10,500, and that's just to buy the chemicals so we can make the identification. We do have a fiscal note attached to the bill that has $10,000 for the standards to be able to do that. And anticipating, again, given the testimony we've heard, a reasonable amount of submissions, we are asking for an additional body.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Maybe you could refresh my memory on punishment. So there's a municipal law in place. There's a federal law that could be in place very soon or will be in place?
There's a federal law for at least one of these that's currently in place, and five of these other chemicals will be listed in federal law hopefully in the next few months.
And then there we would be enacting a state law. And could someone be prosecuted, some 17-year-old kid caught with a couple ounces of this stuff, then theoretically be prosecuted under the muni law, state law, and the federal law?
At least under the state and federal law. The muni law, I would, well, theoretically they're going to, for possession, the testimony in House Judiciary was yesterday, they haven't, I think, prosecuted anybody for possession. They've done some civil citations up there. So theoretically, you could issue a civil citation and prosecute for the state law offense, and then the feds could choose to prosecute for the federal offense.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment, but we're building a $350 million prison right now. There's estimates we're going to need another one in 10 years. We keep passing laws like this. We're going to keep needing probably a new one every 5 or 10 years more after that.
Further questions from Mr. Dimm? Questions from Mr. Luckup. Jerry, I think if you could just reiterate, I asked basically have we made this broad enough to capture the new versions but narrow enough to make it constitutional? Your answer is?
Yes. That would be my opinion. This is like what we went through in the 80s with MDMA and ecstasy and stuff. Through the chair. They're the chemists were creating these new drugs, and, you know, people thought, why don't we just do something and say anything that's similar to this? Well, that didn't work. You know, that didn't provide the requisite notice. If you're going to take somebody's liberty away for a felony for an extended period of time, the criminal law, you know, the constitutional basis for that is that this person has to have notice of what that law is ahead of time and what that chemical is that we're going to make illegal. And so those attempts to do that were unsuccessful at that time. And so we've been stuck in this position. When these designer drugs are created, we just have to add them. A lot of the times, you know, you've got all these drugs in the schedules, and we've got, you know, goes on for pages and pages. The six schedules that we have. Schedule 6 is this one drug, marijuana, but the others. And a lot of these drugs you don't see very often. They were created, we made them illegal, they went away. Others that were either easy to replicate or cheap or able to do in your own garage or basement continue around, and these others just sort of go by the wayside once we make them illegal.
And that's been a sort of a debate I've had with myself over this particular substance And I guess I'm disheartened by the experience so far in the municipality. My assumption was that all you got to do is make this illegal, and it disappears from the shelves. People stop seeking it out. It doesn't. I don't know why they'd seek this out over things that are far more readily available, like marijuana. That's, you know, the substance that it's designed to replicate.
That's the idea behind this. And
right.
And once the feds make it, then the stuff won't be getting imported.
It just goes away. And so it's not like you fill your jail. You'll go back to filling your jails full of people who use marijuana and cocaine, not people who use this.
Well, in some instances, it will become harder to get these things. Right now, you can. Some of the trouble with the spice and the K2 or the spike or whatever name the packet is there's no that user doesn't know what they're getting. Which one of these chemicals they're getting, or how many of them might be added into it. Someone that wanted to do this can order it directly from the chemical company in the Cayman Islands or overseas. You can order the chemical itself that you want, and then, you know, suspend a little portion of it in a solution and then spray it on whatever you want, on tobacco if you want to, and be sure of what you're getting. So there. You know, as long as that the feds keep it open, it's going to be still coming in. We're going to have trouble keeping it out. If we make it illegal, some legitimate resellers of this stuff, you know, should go away. The head shops theoretically aren't going to run the risk of going to jail for a felony, and especially for a higher level felony for selling it to a kid.
Senator Passman?
No.
Question? No. Yes, no. Senator Wilkowski? Senator Coghill?
Just, I appreciated the discussion. You guys dug in way deeper than I thought. But the two questions that remain in my mind is, I think we know how to figure out who's selling it. We don't know how to figure out who's using it, the way I understand it at this point. But this bill, I think, sends a message to those who are both selling and using. And I'm not a big fan of letting them keep selling it, but an immediate effective date was the thing that caught my attention, apart from the fact of how do we test it, you know. So maybe to Mr. Luckup, just the immediate effective date, do we think that the legislative hearing is enough notice for people to, let's just say we pass this out, the governor signs it on the 1st of April, you know. Is that enough notice?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, that is fine notice. The head shops, I think, will be aware of what's occurring in this period of time while we're waiting for the governor's signature. And I don't have a problem in a prosecution occurring under those circumstances, and I doubt there would be a problem in with the court.
It probably just moves from the front counter to the back counter on the day that the governor signs the bill.
And, you know, or just out of the counter completely. And, okay. You know, people.
That was my only question. I don't mind it if it gets a headline somewhere along the line that the legislature is contemplating it. And then the other question is, it looks like it would be much easier prosecuting sellers than it is buyers at this point.
Well, through the chair, Senator Coghill, you know, with the end user, with doing the testing for the end user is, I think, the issue right now. But like anything, I'm sure there's businesses out there that are seeking for, in the employment context, that they'll be able to come up with a test for including this in your analysis. The representative from the municipality was saying that there's like five companies that say they can test for your analysis right now. And there are companies. I found one that published a little thing last November, December, saying they had to come up with a test for this. And it's not hard. You just have to go through a certain amount of work, probably more work than creating the drug, to come up with the way to find it. The idea is that you've still got to, if you get these packets, knowing whether it's marijuana or not, this clearly doesn't look like marijuana. It's just what I think Lieutenant Dial was testifying from the troopers about the concept of, you know, they don't regularly send marijuana off to get tested, you know, and there's issues with prosecutions under our law and our constitution. And with this stuff, you don't necessarily know that it's spice unless you see that packet that might give you some information, idea, you know, who's to know it's not this and not just some other organic materials, truly incense. So there's always going to be some issues with that prosecution of that end user.
Is there anyone else online who wants to testify about SB 17? Anyone else in the room wants to testify about SB 17?
There's a guy in the back.
SB 17? Come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
For the record, my name is Zachary Alexander Pease. I'm a Genoite.
Mr. Pease, go
ahead. Basically, I just wanted to say, like, this is the most volatile, disgusting drug I think I've seen in Juneau in a long time, since the big Oxycontin deal hit, I guess. And I just wanted to make sure that you guys had testimony from somebody who actually got tricked into smoking it and had a horrible time and ended up with an infection in my throat and lungs and had to be on antibiotics for a week. So, yeah.
That's very helpful.
Any other and, yeah, as a young person, I think that we need to get this off the streets as soon as possible.
Questions for Mr. Pease? I don't see any. I appreciate you taking the time to testify. It's actually very helpful.
Thank you.
The questions I've had about the bill were answered today's hearing. Is there any other committee member who has information he needs? I would say he or she, but there's only he's here. I usually say he or she just out of courtesy. But anyone else, any information someone needs to make a decision about the bill? Senator Wilkowski.
Could I get from the Department of Law the number of people that are in jail in Alaska for possession of drugs? I'd be interested.
Do we have a person from the Department of Law? He or she is not available. So it's a fair question. There's a bill, I think, coming over from the House on the subject. We've given it an hour and 5 minutes. I'm going to hold the bill over to the next hearing, and we'll get that information.
And if we also costs as well to incarcerate those people.
If you could frame those as direct questions, get them to my staff. We'll pass them off to the Department of Law, and we'll get an answer to the next hearing. I think it's a fair question. So with that, we'll set the bill aside. Thank you all so much for your work on this bill today. Now we have another easy bill, SB 11.
Today's easy bill day, Mr. Chairman.
Easy bill day. SB 11 was before us in the last hearing. We took public testimony. There's been a lot of public input about the bill since then. I'm going to keep public testimony closed. We do have the bill before us, and we have an amendment from Senator Coghill. Why don't we go ahead, and once everybody's gotten oriented and got the bill in front of them, and turn to Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I don't think I have the amendment that I've received.
Mr. Chairman, it's the A.2 Lockhart Amendment, and the amendment effectively takes the first section out of the bill, is all it does. And I haven't been convinced that having a primary crime, so...
That's your amendment? Are you ready to move it?
Yes, I'll move amendment number one.
I'll object. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, adding a crime is something that I'm reluctant to do at this point. It's a motivation crime, which I think we have a whole new level of discussion we have to get to. I anticipate that this will kind of move along, but I wanted to register my concern that the motivation by prejudice as a primary crime, number one, and then added to another primary crime, number two, are things that that I don't understand well. I'm not ready to go down that road with. And I think if we're going to discuss it, I think doing it in the aggravator section is probably the more appropriate. I would probably debate some of the language in the aggravator, but at least, in my view, more appropriately, it belongs there. So the crime of motivation by prejudice, bias, or hatred added on to another crime, because what you're going to do is change an A felony, an A misdemeanor to a B, a C felony to an A misdemeanor. Are you going to
just as a point of order, it's the other way around.
Yeah, the other way around.
More
Thank
serious,
you.
Yep.
But what you're doing is ratcheting up a notch based on this motivation. And I know I'm the only non-practicing lawyer on this committee, but it just doesn't make sense to me. So, therefore, I move the amendment. I'll be open to discussion.
I'll maintain my objection. Senator Pascan.
Sure. As a point of discussion, you know, within the general context of homicides, meaning, you know, the unlawful taking of human life, we make that determination, everything from negligent conduct to reckless conduct to wanton conduct to planned, premeditated, and deliberate. And, you know, this is no different a categorization or classification than within the category of homicides. And so, you know, I don't think it's a crime to a crime. It is just within a category, for example, of homicide, of how we treat various types of homicide.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I understand that the motivation has these various different levels to it, but bias, hatred fall upon knowingly, and so I understand that standard. The part of a primary crime being a bias or a hatred then has, to me, a whole different kind of sidebar discussion to the culpable mental state. So I'm not prepared at this point, so therefore the amendment. I didn't know how else to address the bill other than just try to amend it out as a primary crime. I think the aggravator, you still get to the motivation issue, it's still a primary crime issue, and it still gives huge discretion to those who are making a judgment on a primary crime issue that falls on itself to those whole different levels of, but here we're taking the whole Title 11 into account on this very issue of bias, hatred, and prejudice. I don't know that I'm ready to go down that road yet.
And I will, let me just say a few words about the amendment, because the amendment basically, in my view, removes the significant portion of, you know, half the bill. And so while some of these comments are directed more at the bill, they're also directed at the amendment, and I'll save you all me making two speeches. I'll just make one. So a little bit of latitude. And, you know, it's interesting. I was watching a history last night of a movie about the history of the state of Alaska, and they talked about the creation of our Constitution. And one of those phrases that they were using in describing the history of the Constitution caught my ear about one of our foundational portions of our Constitution. And so I went and grabbed a copy of it this morning. And this is Article 1, the Declaration of Rights of our Constitution, Section 3, very, very, you know, appears very early in our Constitution. It says this: no person is to be denied the enjoyment of any civil or political right because of race, color, creed, sex, or national origin. And then it says this, and then it says the legislature shall implement this section. And it's funny because it sounded to me like a commandment, in essence, to pass this very bill. It seems like they're telling me that I've got to make a special case against someone who's trying to deny someone their enjoyment of a civil or political right because of their race, their color, their creed, their sex, or their national origin. And so I think that's point one, is that it's pretty clear that our Constitution holds those specific rights very, very high. I think the second point to make, and you haven't made it, Senator Coghill, and I appreciate that, but I've gotten it in many, many emails, and so it's important for the public who may be listening or watching to hear this, and that is that this bill is not, and I repeat, not, and I'll say it a third time, not directed against speech. In some countries, it's true, hate crimes legislation has been used against people who say things that others find offensive, but that will never, ever happen in this country as long as we have a First Amendment. And if you need any examples, I guess the best example is the Westboro Baptist Church, which frequently holds demonstrations at the funerals of soldiers, demonstrations that many people find deeply, deeply offensive. and I am one who find them offensive. Nevertheless, those demonstrations go on. They go on with the protection of the First Amendment, and they go on as long as there is a First Amendment. So this is not about speech. There's no preacher in this nation who will be charged with a hate crime for anything he or she says from a pulpit based on the passage of this bill. I guess I'll go on to point out that the paradigmatic hate crime, I went to Wikipedia to get a little history on hate crimes, and the first example of a hate crime, they say, is this. Examples from the past include Roman persecution of Christians. The next example is the Ottoman genocide of Armenians, and the next example are various Nazi pogroms. So this can be a shield or a sword depending on what is in the mind of the perpetrator, the criminal perpetrator. And as a former prosecutor, I can tell you, and Senator Pascoe has alluded to, that it's a difficult thing to prove. It's always hard to prove what's in someone's mind. And so the vast majority of these crimes will never be prosecuted as hate crimes. They'll be prosecuted as the simple assaults they are. But it's important to point out that this bill doesn't make a special class out of anyone, or I guess you could put it another way, it makes a special class out of all of us. If you're attacked because of what you represent, it's more offensive than just simply being attacked. And so I think it's important to keep those in mind. And finally, I'll just say that it's been a federal crime to commit a hate crime since 1994. That basic hate crime legislation was amended a couple of years ago to include gender and gender identity. But the basic federal hate crime bill has been on the books since 1994, and it's used very sparingly because these are difficult crimes to prosecute. So that's my little speech against your amendment. Further, do you want some wrap-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think there is a lot of fear that special cases are going to be made. I think America is going to be debating that for a good long while. So my amendment was really trying to focus in on what I think is the crime issue here. If somebody gets assaulted, whether it's whatever, just take Title 11 and figure whatever the assault would be from the most deadly to the least deadly. I think that the very amendment that you, or the very part of the Constitution you quoted, showed not only do we have a duty to implement law, but we also have a duty to uphold that Constitution. But once again, the bias and hatred then become, to me, very, very subjective. I think we've debated this on a national level. And I personally think that if we're going to do that, the aggravator part of a crime is the way to do that rather than making it the primary crime. Because once again, I think prosecution is going to become exceeding difficult under the primary crime and probably will fall out to the aggravator as a problem. To me, it properly belongs as an aggravator issue, because that's when you determine if it was done based on somebody's prejudice or their bias against somebody because they are a Christian or a Muslim or a certain gender or gender identity even. So looking at this, trying to think, how would I at least speak to it? I think we should all have equal protection under the law, and I think if somebody gets killed, maimed, or somehow assaulted, they should be equally protected by somebody, regardless of what the bias is, because that equality, to me, is very, very important. And what we're going to do now is every crime that we see, that we're going to go on a hunt for a bias or a prejudice that becomes a hunt for a new crime, rather than treating the assault as the action that it was. Whatever the mental culpable state, whatever the motivation we can come to, this adds a whole new element to every crime that we have in Title 11. And I think that that creates a dynamic that I'm not, I think is unwise in our law. I understand it's a federal crime, but I see the aggravator as the best way to go, because then you get to determine if there was, on that particular crime, something that aggravated it so egregiously that sentencing becomes the issue, or the punishment for the crime then gets a chance to either look at, what, quite frankly, a mitigator or an aggravator. So I just think it properly belongs there, and I understand your debate. I agree with portions of your debate. But I think just this kind of double-time precedent is something that either I don't understand well enough, or at least at this point I'm not willing to go with you on. So I'd like to bring that to a vote. I know we ran our time really long on the last bill, so I'll just put it there.
There we have it. The clerk would call the roll, please.
Senator Wilikowski.
No.
Senator Pashbent.
No.
Senator Coghill.
Yes.
Senator French.
No.
Three noes, one yes.
By a vote of 3-1, the amendment fails. That brings the bill back before us. Are there further amendments to Senate Bill 11? Seeing none, what's the will of the committee? Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move Senate Bill number 11 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection?
I'll object, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill, do you want to speak to your objection?
Mr. Chairman, I think we already spoke to it. There's much discussion on hate crimes generally in America, and I fall on the part where I think that as close to equality as we can, we should get to. And the hate crimes discussion starts adding, I think, specialties to that that I think are unwise. And so I'm going to object to this moving forward, but primarily at this point on the manner in which we're going about it, having it as a primary crime.
And I'll just say that here are some more examples of typical hate crimes, and when I read these, I think you can see why they're hate crimes. It's because they're directed at a person because of their status, and for many of us, we find that particularly wrong. It's wronger than just the underlying sometimes horrific event. But hate crimes in the U.S. include lynchings of African Americans. They include cross burnings to drive black families from predominantly white neighborhoods. They include assaults on white people traveling in predominantly black neighborhoods. They include assaults on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. They include the painting of swastikas on Jewish synagogues and xenophobic responses to a variety of minority ethnic groups. And let's just take the example of a swastika on a Jewish synagogue. We can all see that is, you could just say, well, that's just simple criminal mischief. It's just the destruction of someone else's property. Or you can see it as representing something far more powerful and something more evil and something more worthy of condemnation and punishment. And I think that's why in some cases we say if we can measure your intent, and if your intent is in some senses more evil, more wrong than the simple underlying crime, we're going to escalate and punish it more severely. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My eyes were opened on this particular issue when I had the experience of living in Japan for a few years. And I think most people think of Japan as being a fairly enlightened society. We actually wrote their constitution after World War II, General MacArthur. It is a very good constitution, in fact. But I was regularly stopped by the police and asked for my ID or my passport because I didn't look Japanese. I regularly couldn't go to Japanese restaurants because I didn't look Japanese. There were other public places that I couldn't go, and they would have signs up that said no foreigners allowed. I'm glad that we live in a country that doesn't tolerate that. I'm glad that I live in a state that doesn't tolerate that. This is one further thing that we can put into place to say we as a society don't tolerate these sorts of things. You shouldn't discriminate against people for the way they look, the way they act, where they come from.
Just make one comment.
Senator Pashbent.
You know, I think that both the United States and Alaska are civilly diverse societies, and no segment of that society should be intimidated that they should be removed from this society by the conduct of others. So I think that the reprehensibility of motivations targeting segments of civilly diverse societies, that reprehensibility of motivation is, I think, something that our Constitution says that we should protect civilly diverse societies.
Wrap up, Senator Coghill.
Just a point. I agree with the constitutional mandate. I fear that in many cases, the more we define them, the more we give tools to people to intimidate other people, and that is one of the backlashes of trying to define these all along the way. So it's just a concern that I have as we go down this road that it doesn't become the tool to actually intimidate other people for whatever reason. And so I also agree that those things that have been most egregious in America's history, I think we have tried to deal with them. Alaska has done dealt with them very well. On the other hand, I think the more we define them, the more tools we have actually to create more division rather than try to say everybody is equal. So I'm going to vote against the bill. I appreciate you letting me have the chance to speak to it.
There's been a motion to move the bill. There's an opposition to the motion. The motion's been debated. Clerk, would call the roll, please.
Senator Coghill.
No.
Senator Willikowski.
Yes.
Senator Passbend.
Yes.
Senator French.
Yes.
3 yeas, 1 nay.
By a vote of 3-1, the bill has left our committee and on to the next committee of referral. That brings us down to the last little bit of work we have to do today, and that's SB 39. U.S. Presidential Election Compact. We had a presentation on the bill. We took exhaustive public testimony on the bill. I wanted to let it sit for a few days to see if members had amendments or suggestions. Any amendments offered to SB 39? Don't see any. What's the will of the committee with respect to SB 39? Senator Willikowski.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move Senate Bill 39 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there an objection? Senator Coghill.
Seems like I'm in the minority today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Willikowski hit the nail right on the head as we were discussing it the last time, and that is if we're going to be a country of states or a country of a general population. And because of the way we're made up as a country, I'm going to stick with a country of states. I think compacting out some of our state responsibility, I just disagree with. So I'm going to vote against this particular bill. But I have appreciated the lively argument, and I can see how people could agree with this. I just don't.
And I'll speak to your objection and just say that this is exactly what the founders envisioned. That is us as state legislatures exercising our prerogative to think about better ways of doing business. It's one of the few aspects of our work that's delegated to us directly from the United States Constitution. We as state legislators have the authority to better shape how we award our electors. And I personally want to see a system that makes absolutely certain that the person sitting in the White House is the person who got the most votes. And I think any other result is a travesty. I just don't see how in a system that believes itself as a democracy, you can follow a president who got less than the majority vote. And so I think this is a step in that direction. And that's why I'm the bill sponsor. Further debate. There's been an objection to moving the bill, an opposition and debate. If the clerk would call the roll, please.
Senator Coghill.
No.
Senator Willikowski.
Yes.
Senator Passbend.
Yes.
Senator French.
Yes.
3 yeas, 1 nay.
By a vote of 3-1, the motion to move the bill from committee is carried. And so the bill will be moved on to the next committee referral. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.